Hi folks, this is Jack Spierko with another edition of the Survival Podcast. As always, one man's view of the changing world, the changing times, and the things we can all do to live a better life if times get tough or even if they don't. Today is March 23rd, 2015, and this is episode 1540 of the Survival Podcast. And it is a Monday, so it's time for your feedback. This is where you send me emails with the moniker TSPC in the subject line. Then you can put question for Jack, comment for Jack, idea, concept, whatever. I don't care. But just make sure TSPC, Tango, Sierra, Papa, Charlie, is in the subject line. The ducks distracted me there. Sorry. But just make sure that's in the subject line. It'll help me pull it out of the spam box if it for some reason ends up in there. Anyway, before I get to your feedback today, let's go ahead and take care of our sponsors. They do a lot to help take care of you. Sponsor of the day, number one today, is WesternBotanicals.com. You know what? After this weekend that I'll tell you about a bit, I climbed into a bottle of the turmeric formula from Western Botanicals on a Saturday night after spending all day with a bunch of guys working out in the yard, and it did me well. I took a few more on Sunday morning. It was a great weekend, but, you know, I ended up aching and tired, and I ended up, you know, up very early getting everything ready for everybody and up really late after everybody left cleaning everything up, so you end up sore. So do you reach for the, you know, bottle of Motrin or whatever? I don't. I prefer to not destroy my kidneys, just saying, and I look for something herbal. You may want to consider doing that for yourself. If you do, a great place to find stuff like that is at WesternBotanicals.com. Where real people that really care about you will answer the phone if you give them a call and ask them for customer service. And you'll get somebody in Utah, not in Delhi. Again, I'm just saying. Check them out today. And remember, they do a discount for members of the Support Brigade. They have a program that's $50 a year. It's their premium membership program. And that gives you 25% off everything they sell. Or you can join the Member Support Brigade and get it for free. Once again, I'm just saying, check them out. Western Botanicals, a long-term premium supporter of the SurvivalPodcast.com. Next up today will be JM Bullion. You know, when you look at the government's plan for your money, it is to make your money worth less. You understand the most insidious tax you pay is what's called the inflation tax. Ron Paul even got Ben Bernanke, former chairman of the Federal Reserve, to admit that inflation was a hidden tax on the American people on the floor of Congress. I don't think people realize how monumentous a moment that was. So basically, when they say inflation will be 2 to 4% a year, that means you pay 2 to 4% property tax on your own money every year, over and over, over and over, and over and over again. And the more wealth you acquire, the bigger the tax you pay. The only way I know to truly avoid that is by investing long-term in silver and gold. And when I'm doing that, I go to jmbullion.com to get my silver and gold. When you look at their prices, you look at their free shipping policy, you look at what their assortment is, you'll see why. And if you ever have an issue and you get in touch with them for customer service at a personal level, you'll see why. They are the best supplier at the best price that I've found in years of being involved with this industry. I've had my ups and downs to silver and gold. Some of you know that. When I find the right people, I stick with them. These are the right guys. Check them out today if you haven't before. JMBullion.com. And they do give a discount to members of the Support Brigade on purchases of $300 and up. Next up, want to do the history segment with you, the year 1540. We have O. Henry, the king doubles up on his wives. And then we have global warming in the midst of the Little Ice Age. And then we have our Father Abraham's Synagogue and the West Bank of the Jordan River. I'm going to read global warming in the midst of the Little Ice Age. It's a little too juicy not to. The Rhine has run dry and the river scene has gone insane. Record temperatures this summer have scorched the earth, ruining the German and French wine industry. The wine industry reached its peak a few years back, but it was cut off at the knees during the German Peasants' Rebellion and took place mainly in the German wine-growing regions. Parts of modern-day France and its wine industry are actually part of Germany at this time. The lack of labor, the breakdown of infrastructure in the valleys, and the ongoing heat and drought have brought a growth to an end. In modern days, the Rhine is the busiest river in the world. During World War II, the Nazis tried to blow up a bridge across the Rhine. They failed, and as the Allied troops came across, the soldier placed assigned the Red, crossed the Rhine with dry feet, courtesy of the 9th Armored Division. 1540, you didn't need a bridge. You could walk across the Rhine dry shod. My Take by Alex Shrugged. Well, yearly changes in weather do not indicate general trends in climate change. Yet that is exactly what the shills of global warming and global cooling want us to believe. That this hurricane or that snowstorm validates their hypothesis. When I was a kid, the very people who are warning about global warming were warning us about a coming ice age. In the 6th grade, I wrote a short story about people escaping glaciers. Newsweek magazine was shouting global cooling from the rooftops. It is instructive to hear the voice of 1975. I was a college student at that time. What should I have believed when scientists told me this? And this is a quote from 1975. The central fact is that after 3/4 of a century of extraordinary mild conditions, the Earth's climate seems to be cooling down. Meteorologists disagree about the cause and the extent of the cooling trend, as well as its overall specific impact on local weather conditions. But they are almost unanimous in the view that the trend will reduce agricultural productivity for the rest of the century. If the climate change is as profound as some pessimists fear, the resulting famines could be catastrophic. Because of global cooling. 1975. Be pissed if you want to, but I didn't write it. It's not my opinion. It's the almost unanimous opinion of science in 1975. See, we don't have to go back to the 1500s to find out where science was effing wrong. All we have to do is go back to, like, yesterday. But anyway, 1975 for this, you know, complete blunder about the way things would work out. Let me tell you guys, though, that think that my stance on global warming means that I think we can just pollute the planet, that you are messed up in the head. Let me tell you what I think the entire agenda from above with the climate change nonsense is. It is not just to get a global tax put in. In fact, they don't care about a global tax. What they care about is making money, and a cap and trade system is a way for everybody to make money, especially the evil oil companies. Yes, the evil oil companies will make so much money with cap and trade. They are totally for it, especially since they are also the people that own the oil companies. I know this is hard for you to understand. They own the effing banks too, okay? And the banks are going to make ass loads of money trading fake money in the world of carbon credits. The carbon tax is nothing but a new Ponzi scheme of money. Okay? So yeah, they want that, but that's not the real agenda. The real agenda is that the people that run these industries are destroying the planet. They are polluting the planet. They are doing horrible, horrible things to our planet. We may be seeing a dying off of species right now that is indicative of 6X, the 6th Great Extinction. Why? Is it natural or man-made? Who gives a shit? What retard are you to be like, well, is it natural or man-made? I think we have a problem. I don't think I care why. I think I care that. But do you know what the agenda is? The agenda is to make sure that the two sides cannot have a logical discussion about how to fix the actual problem. See, when you fog a mirror with your exhalation, you are exhaling CO2, the very pollutant that they say is so bad. Now, you see those smokestacks and all the global warming commercials? Look at this horrible CO2. Do you know what color CO2 is? It's effing invisible. So when you see all that smoke coming out, do you know what's making the colors? All the real pollution that's screwing up our planet. All the mercury going into our oceans. All the trioxins and dioxins and sulfur oxides and everything else that these assholes are destroying our planet with, which I'm sure has an effect on climate at regional levels. I'll also tell you that modern agricultural practices that are creating deserts all over the world are affecting the climate negatively. I don't know if it warms or cools. It doesn't matter. It's not good. Cutting down the frickin' rainforest, not good for the climate. Got it? Destroying the planet. And then they take the right and go, look at these crazy, wacko environmentalists. To the point where the people on the right go, I don't believe in environmentalism. I've had right-wing people tell me I don't believe environmentalism. I don't believe in it. The polarization is asinine. And then the other side, the only thing they give a shit about is CO2 and global warming. The most myopic moron. I don't care if you believe it's real. How stupid do you have to believe, B, to just focus on this one narrow ass thing when there's all this other shit that you could take to the other side and go, look at this, look at this, look at this, look at this, and look at this. And you know what they'd say? Yeah, that's a problem. We should do something about that. And then there'd be less CO2. Not that I give a shit, but there would be. The whole point is this. God, I'm sorry I'm on a tangent so early today, but listen, please get this through your head. If you will simply pull your head out of your asses long enough to understand the concept of pattern recognition, you will see this stuff so clearly. Okay, it is the same thing. It is the exact same thing being done with law enforcement right now. You have people on one side going, listen, you guys are being abusive. You guys are not following the Constitution. You guys are screwing the citizenry over. And you have law enforcement officers going, and you got people that support cops blindly going, hey, you're all just a bunch of assholes. Okay? Now, what we actually need is the two sides to have a not hands up, don't shoot bullshit, because that's not what happened. That's not what happened, retards. It's not what happened. Instead of hands up, don't shoot, we need to be sitting down, legitimately, talking about how do we solve this issue? How do we get people to stop antagonizing cops, and how do we get cops to do their effing jobs instead of abusing effing citizens? Okay? But we want a polarization where those two sides cannot converse. So everybody screams at each other, hands up, don't shoot, you're an asshole. Got it? That's what's being done with climate change. While the people that are stirring the pot are pouring poisons into your atmosphere and onto your grounds and turning fertile land fallow and salting the earth with agricultural practices that are 10,000 years old and way past the point that we should be utilizing them, okay? While they're doing that, they're lathering up one side of supposed environmentalists and lathering up the other side of people in direct opposition to them. Why? Because they do not want the two sides to have a legitimate conversation about what the actual problems are. So let's fight about the air we exhale. Do you get it? Please get this. And I'll tell you why it's important. It's not important because of the individual issue. It's important because it's what's being done with every single divisive issue in the free world, if you can even call it that anymore, at this time. They're doing it with gay marriage. They're doing it with marijuana. They're doing it with everything. Polarization to the extreme, and the people causing the polarization don't really give a shit. They just want to control you, control your country, take away your liberty, and get your money into their pockets. Please understand that. The second you recognize the pattern, then you will see it everywhere. It's not perception bias. In fact, I would tell you it's perception bias that prevents you from seeing the problem. It's not cognitive dissonance. It's cognitive dissonance that prevents you from seeing the problem. I would like to ask the people that are part of the permaculture movement that are all about carbon and climate change, if God appeared before you, whatever God you believe in, and said, my child, it's all bullshit. Stop believing in this bullshit. It's not important. This is not the problem. Would you stop doing what you're doing? And you believed him, by the way. It was really God. You really believed him. Like, okay, well, it's not CO2 that's the problem. Would you just say, you know what? This permaculture thing, this environmentalist thing's not worth doing. Or would you say, look, well, there's like 1,000 other reasons to do this. Let's do it for those reasons. Maybe, in those little brain cells where you know that, you know all those other reasons, maybe if you want the other side to listen to you, here's a hint. Talk about those. They just might listen to you. Or do you not want to be listened to? Do you want your little fiefdom to think you're in an illusionary battle with evil people? Which one is it? Anyway, sorry to go off on that, but you know what? That's just, I see this so clearly. Right now I'm reading a book. It's called Shame of Man. It is the second in a series of books from a guy named Piers Anthony. The first is Isle of Women. And it traces the history of a single family as it's reborn in different time eras. It starts off when they're basically chimpanzees. Does Jack believe in evolution? You bet your ass I do. Anyway, doesn't matter because it's a fictitious story. And it takes them all the way through up until modern times and into the future even. A little bit of a dystopian view of the future, which maybe it's not dystopian, maybe it's accurate. I don't know. Anyway, so when you're reading this, you're reading about these customs of the time, like the guy with the left hand and he uses his left hand is evil. It's bad. It's not. It shouldn't do that. Superstitious, huh? But when the ocean's not doing what you want and the boat is being blown off course, they bring a guy up to the front to play a flute to appease the gods. And if the wind changes, they say he did a good job. And if it doesn't, they just might kill him because he didn't make the gods happy, even though he wasn't the one that caused it in the first place. And when the glaciers are advancing, the shaman goes out and chants, whatever, right? Okay? And it's going to stop the glacier. With climate, that's what we're doing now. We're doing the same thing. We're just using fancy words to describe it. Instead of just saying, you know what, the climate is what the climate is. How about we look at all the pollution and all of the horrible practices that industry and agriculture are committing in the name of progress, and ask ourselves if there's a better way to do them. That's not something that, like, that the right and the left could have an honest conversation about. I don't expect it to happen anytime soon because, well, people are much more easily divided than they are united. We generally don't unite people in an effort to solve problems. We unite them against an enemy, a scary boogeyman enemy. That's another pattern that we'll save for another day. Let's go ahead and take your first email and see how much of this stuff lines up with the pattern of divide both sides so they don't talk to each other today. Not that I planned it that way. I didn't even know what the history segment was until about 5 minutes before I read it. Actually, first, let me give you a little bit of what happened at the TSP Work with Jack weekend. We had a blast. It rained a bit. It didn't rain anywhere as much as we thought it would. I thought it was going to pour. That's what the forecast said. But it just rained like misty rain on and off all day. So we started off over in the food forest. We planted about 150 support trees. I went back and looked at it this morning. We probably crammed some more in there before it's all over with as we get into spring. But we got that done. And we got that done really, really fast. And we looked at it. We thought, well, maybe it's not going to rain too much. And the problem with trenching for the irrigation that we did in the rain is, well, what happens if it pours while the ditch is open? It just turns into a slurry of nastiness. But we figured we'd give it a shot, and we put in a couple hundred foot of irrigation. We put in a small micro swale, about 3 foot wide, about 4 inches deep. We planted about 60 rows of Ragusa for the living hedge. We got all of that glued up, and we got all the irrigation heads in. We got it mulched. We got a cover crop seeded. We had a blast. What I've learned is plan on more meat. I did 2 pork shoulders, and I split them into afternoon and evening. And I think everybody ate well enough, but I think there was probably some people that could use a little more meat. So next time around, I'll throw a couple big rings of sausage or something in there because I want to be able to feed, even though I didn't promise to feed people at the end of the day. When it's 5 o'clock and we're wrapping up and having beers, I want people to be able to eat. So that's why I split the meat into 2 batches so that it would work out that way. So we'll definitely add more meat. I think everybody had a blast. We got to meet a lot of really great people. And we're doing it again this weekend, the 28th. And there's a link in today's show notes where you can learn more about that. But basically, you send me an email with TSPC3-28-15 in the subject line. Tell me you want to come. There is a forum thread for people that want to carpool. I limit the cars to about 12 cars, and I think I can cram a couple more in if I do some things in advance this time around to make more room. I can't have people in the West Pasture anymore, especially with the, it's probably going to rain again between then and now, and it's really a mess over there. Right now I have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 already registered to attend, so it should be a good get-together one way or another. We got all week for that to happen. And a couple people that were here said they liked it and they were coming back next weekend. So if you guys are coming back, don't expect me to remember that you told me that. Please give me an email again, jack@thesurvivalpodcast.com, TSPC3-21-15 in the subject line, and you'll get a document with all the instructions about how to show up and what have you. So our first story of the day, government attacks small family farm in Schenectady County, New York. And this is what I want to know before I even read this. The law enforcement officers that are responding to this, that are seizing this man's horses and giving this man shit, when are you going to follow your oath and say no? When are you going to follow? I want to know from law enforcement officers out there today, if you were asked to do this, would you do it? Because if you would, guess what? You're not following your oath and you're not qualified to do your job. Let me tell you something about being in law enforcement before I continue with this. Wearing a uniform does not mean you're qualified for your job. Graduating from your academy and having whatever type of college courses that your department says you have to have does not qualify for your job. Okay? The only thing that qualifies you to be an officer of the peace in this society is that when you swear to uphold and defend the Constitution of this nation and the Constitution of the state in which you serve, that you understand what you're saying and you mean it. And if you're not willing to say no, up until the point where they threaten your job, you are not qualified for your job and you should not be doing your job. You should go find something else to do, preferably something like washing dishes at a Denny's, because if you're not a man of your word, you should not be a man in blue. Let me say that again. If you're not a man of your word, you should not be a man in blue. And when you say, I swear, you either mean it or you don't. And if you mean it, I will shake your hand and thank you for your service. And if you don't, I consider you to be a piece of shit. Hello. And that means yes. No one said it would be easy. If you don't do this, Officer Smith, you might be terminated. You know what? Do the same thing you guys do when you get accused of abuse. File a grievance with your union and refuse to comply with an order when you feel that it is in violation of the Constitution. And I feel what's going on here is a violation of the Constitution of the United States. And it's a direct result of people making laws about animals that do not know anything about animals. And the other thing is the people of Schenectady, why aren't there 5,000 of you burning down the phone lines to the prosecutor's office, the judge's office, the police department that's doing this? Where the local regulators? Where are you? Where are you? Here, you want to know what's going on? Here's the basic timeline of what goes on. I don't want to read the whole article. On Wednesday, February 26, people show up and inquire about unlicensed working dogs at a farm called... I'm sorry, let me find that real quick for you. West Wind Acres. I knew it was West Wind something. So Westwood Acres in Schenectady. Police show up on February 25th, inquire about unlicensed working dogs. The owner, Josh, shows them around the farm uninterrupted. He would have been off to do his afternoon chores. So the authorities observe the animals only have frozen weather at the time. Hydration tests are given, and still Josh is and passed. And Josh is given a ticket for failure to provide proper sustenance. Oh, by the way, at the same time, all the pipes were frozen, and all the residents of the surrounding towns had no water at their house. So was the city guilty of failure to provide proper sustenance to its citizens that pay for their water, by the way? Okay. February 26th. In an attempt to get ahead of the problem, Josh calls his veterinarian and makes an appointment at a farm for a farm wellness check. Okay. So he has his own vet comes out. 27th, vet comes out, files a report that all the animals are fine. This is a veterinarian, you know, a guy that actually studies animals and has basically the equivalence of an MD for animals, which is actually harder to get than a regular MD, by the way. Police return with a search warrant on the 3rd of March, and Josh is informed that more charges might be brought up against him at court the following Thursday. Thursday, March 12th, Josh finds himself facing 12 charges in Glenville Town Court because you idiots in Glenville apparently don't have anything better to do than jack around with a farmer, okay? Covering problems with drinking water in various frozen states. Did you know water freezes in the winter, dumbasses? The lack of available feed and the absence of adequate shelter for the animals in his care because Josh still believes in transparency. You can see them all here and there's a link. Sunday, March 15th. The guy that wrote this article drives up to the farm to see the operation for himself, wanted to buy a couple of chickens to help provide income to the farm. But when he arrived, there were more police and a trailer. Without trial and with a clean bill of health from the vet, authorities stole his horses. Okay, again, the law enforcement officers that participated in that broke your oath. You know it's wrong. You should have said no. You should have said, well, you know what, Sarge, do it yourself. And Sarge should have said, you know what, Lieutenant, do it yourself. The day you guys will refuse to comply with orders that are bullshit is the day the bullshit stops happening. That's part of your responsibility, guys. Okay? And don't write me and say, you don't understand. I understand perfectly. I understand doing the right thing in the face of being threatened with your employment is difficult. And if you're not willing to do that, you're not qualified to be a police officer. Got it? See, because the oath matters. All right? The police want to seize his pigs, which are perfectly healthy, but right now they've left them in place because they don't have any place to put them. Now, I'm back to the article here. The irony of all this is Josh is being charged with cruelty to animals and not providing them proper sustenance. Yet in many states, it's perfectly okay to keep pigs in gestation crates. Here in New York, it's standard practice to keep chickens in unthinkably small cages. You have to burn their beaks off, by the way, so they don't poke each other's eyes out. And I don't even want to get into what passes for animal feed. The care and feeding that Josh's animals get don't seem to be the issue. No, what is the issue here is control. This is pattern recognition again, guys. The people that say, we have to do things sustainably, don't want anything to do with sustainability. I don't know what to do. There's a list of things you can do, like reach out to social media, visit his farm, buy his meat, and hopefully some people will show up at the Glenville Town Hall, March 21st at 5:30 p.m. That's tomorrow. I don't know how many of you guys that listen live near this place, but, I mean, a show of support is necessary. But what should be done is there should be 5,000 people from Schenectady standing tall with this man saying, you're not doing this on our watch. You're just not doing it. We refuse. But, I mean, I see the bigger problem here is law enforcement willing to do whatever it's told. There has to be a point, guys. If you're going to carry the badge, if you're going to carry the gun, if you're going to be willing to use force on your fellow man to require compliance with things up to the point of submission or death, there has to be a point where you say, no, I'm not doing it. And ask yourself right now, if you do that job, where's the line? And should ever the line come that you say it is now and you cross it, the next day, turn your badge in, turn your gun in, and go and find something else to do because you're not qualified. Being qualified to be a law enforcement officer means being qualified to know when to say no to something. To say, do it your damn self. These animals aren't being abused. And you know what else is going on here? This is what happens when people who are idiots about animal care write regulations about animal care. This is what happens when busybodies drive by the road and go, look at the poor cow in the snow, it's horrible. These people would literally have their brains explode if they spent some time on a Montana cattle ranch. What do you think, the cows in Montana can handle being in the snow, but not the ones in New York? This is the most asinine pile of shit I've seen done in regards to attacking sustainable agriculture. And you know, I try to keep you out of the weeds with this thing. Like, it doesn't mean that they're going after everybody that grows their own food, but it sure feels like that at times, doesn't it? Well, if we don't shove it back up their asses in these individual cases, it will happen everywhere. See, once a court rules on something in this country, it becomes a precedent. And it takes a higher court to overturn that. We don't need to get into a position where we need higher courts to overturn this. If you live where this is, make sure you support this man. Tomorrow, get your ass to court. Get your ass to court, stand with this man. Because if you don't stand with him while you can, maybe no one will stand with you when you need it. Let's take another one. This one has me pissed. And again, if anybody in law enforcement thinks I'm being too critical, where's your line? When will you say no? And did you already have a line that you've already crossed? Do some self-examination before you blame me for feeling that an oath is an oath is an oath. It's not about keeping your job. It's about keeping your freaking word. Law enforcement officers, that's my central message to you. Your duty is not to keep your job. It is to keep your word. It is to keep your word. Please do so. Let's take another one. Yeah, in an effort to get out of this anger, let's go to something that has nothing to do with what the ass clowns are doing all around this damn country to screw it up. Larry asks, I think I heard you say on the show with Mark Shepard that you had read Restoration Agriculture. Is that book primarily what you're basing your permaculture designs on? Have you read other books on permaculture? Were you like me and only began the PDM to find it hard to read? I'm up to Chapter 9 of Restoration Agriculture. I have a resilient farm and homestead. We'll read that one as soon as I'm done with Restoration Agriculture, Larry. Larry and everybody else, this is what I think makes it very hard for me to teach because everybody wants a one-size-fits-all pill. No, my primary permaculture designs are not based on Mark Shepard's Restoration Agriculture model. No, they're not based on Jeff Lawton's Greening the Desert model. No, they're not based on the PDM specifically. No, they're not based on the Resilient Farm and Homestead. No, they're not based on Ben Falk or Bill Wilson or anybody else, or Sepp Holzer. I have no allegiance to anything in permaculture except permaculture itself. I use what works for the situation at hand based on the materials and budget available and the climate type and the desires of the property owner, including myself, as far as hours of maintenance, production, and goals. There is no one book you can buy and say, okay, this is what you do. This is how you do permaculture for you. I think if I'm going to design 20 acres, 40 acres, 50 acres, 1,000 acres today, and the client that I'm designing for wants a system that is based on animals and overstory trees and perennial yields on a large, broad scale, I'm probably going to go with Mark Shepard's model as a basis. And I'm probably going to go with a key line-based design system because it fits that. It's that simple, because it fits that model well. It is a production agriculture orientated system. It is a system designed, whether it's a pecan tree or an elderberry, that a mechanical harvester can drive down a row just like they do with corn and do the harvest. It is for large scale implementations. I think the majority of what Mark Shepard does, while brilliant, is fundamentally useless to somebody with a 3-acre farmstead like I have. It's not that certain principles won't work. It's not that you might not emulate silvopasture in a way. You're just not going to do it at the scale or with the intention that Mark Shepard would do if he was designing your 100-acre farm for you. They're different worlds. So I don't really concern myself with them much at all. When the two collide, so to speak. It doesn't mean that you can't perhaps on a small scale grow hazelnut and chestnut and use your prunings from your hazelnut for the purpose of growing shiitake mushrooms the way that Mark does. But the overall layout of the design is not going to be the same. I think my greatest mentor in permaculture is Jeff Lawton. And it's not so much for the projects I've looked at that he's done, but it's for the philosophy that he has that I think he's helped me in part, which is all of it works. All of it works. The key is what works best for you, what works best for the site, what works best for the client's goals and the client's agenda and the client's desires. There are people in permaculture that are married to their ideals to the point where they don't care what their customer wants if they're doing a design project, or they don't care what their student wants if their student has a question. I don't like that. I find that to be very off-putting. I would recommend that if you want to know how to do large-scale silvopasture systems, that Mark Shepard's classes and training with RAD are some of the best you could ever get. Brilliant designer. But if you want to know how to do something in your backyard, don't even bother asking him a question. He doesn't think there. He'll say, I think we should do that in every backyard, and every backyard should be productive, but we can't feed the world with it. And he's right about that. We can't feed the entire world with backyards. We can feed a shitload of people. And the sentiment's right, but he either doesn't know how to design a backyard or doesn't care to bother with it, one or the other. So don't go there for that. Sepp Holzer is going to put terraces and hugel culture everywhere, whether the person wants it or not. So if hugel culture makes sense, traditional high mount hugel culture for what you're trying to do, fine. But if it's not what you want, or it doesn't make sense, you don't do it. So getting to the crux, though, I think that like part of the question, though, is like when you read the permaculture designer's manual, it's hard to read. Yeah, it is. I would not recommend that anybody buy the designer's manual and think you're going to sit down and read it. I think the designer's manual is more for... It's like more like an encyclopedia and needs to be looked at as such. If you're doing a design course, there's all types of material that can be gleaned from it. If you're developing a course, there's all types of material that can be gleaned from it. But it's not an easy-to-read book. But again, I think we do have to, like... Permaculture is about a systems-level thinking. So stop worrying about what so-and-so says or what particular techniques somebody else uses, and say to yourself very, very much up front right from the beginning, what do I want my property to do? How many hours do I want to spend a week, you know, being required to work on this property? What yields do I want? What am I willing to do? What is my budget? In fact, Nick Ferguson and I are kicking around the idea of doing a PDC this year, a permaculture design course. And one of the things that we're thinking about adding, you know, a flat out add to the design practicum is a client analysis. Everybody talks about it. When you look at permaculture and permaculture design courses, people look at it and say, you know, you have to look at the client's needs, right? But just like we do a zone analysis and a sector analysis where we say, okay, here's how the sun energy moves through this property in the summer, in the spring, in the fall, in the winter. And here's where we want to shade it out, or here's where we want to invite it in. And we do a sector analysis that way. Where are there bad views? Where are there positive views? What do we not want to screen out? What do we want to screen out? Where's harsh winds? Where are gentle winds? We do a very systemic analysis of that on a property to determine how we are going to design it. We also do a zone analysis. Where are we going to be every day? Where are we going to be once or twice a week? Where are we going to be every 3 weeks? Where there's natural patterns that we take through our property. Very few people walk on every square foot of a property of any real size every single day. So there's zones there whether we want them or not. They exist. So we do a zone analysis. Like if this is how I get to my car and I go to work every day, well, I know I'm going to walk down that sidewalk every day. So I know I can put something that requires intensive management there. That makes perfect sense, right? So we're going to have a zone one, a zone two, a zone three, et cetera. So one of the things I think we should be doing is an analysis of the client, a schematic analysis, basically looking at the client and the client's family or the client's community, if there's a whole community involved. Who has what strengths? What do they know? How much knowledge do they have? How much work do they really want to put into it? What do they like to eat? What do they not like to eat? What are they really looking for? What are their concerns, short, middle, and long term? Actually analyze the client. You say, well, if I'm doing the design for myself, what do I do then? Then you analyze yourself. Then you do a holistic analysis of yourself. What do I want? What are my concerns? What is my budget? And you try to answer those questions honestly, right? So I think the biggest thing that I want to give you as a takeaway from this is to never think that there is like the method or the way when it comes to something as complex as moving living systems. And I know it would be, and I actually have a question that kind of goes the other way here in just a second with the answer. But I know it would be easier that way. It's actually words out of the next question, plug and play. Like they just had, like, I'll buy this book, it'll say to do these 10 things, I'll do those 10 things, and then I'll have a permaculture system. And it's not exactly impossible, but it doesn't really empower you. If you actually want to know how to do design, then you want to be able to look at it with a systems overview and understand. So I'm sitting now looking at a quarter acre backyard. I know Jack Spearco's going to put swales in. Maybe, maybe not. It depends. I mean, I'm going to start with a sector and zone analysis, and then I'm going to do a client analysis. And if the budget or the goals don't really make sense for swales, then I'm probably not going to put them in. There may end up being swale-like features in there. As we develop a pathway between two locations, we may say, hey, let's take a look at this, and let's find the contour line. And can it get us most of the way there? Oh, if it can, well, then let's put the path on contour. It's now not going to have erosion problems. It's going to now be a swale-like feature. It's going to help infiltrate water. It'll be easier to maintain, but it's not a swale in the true sense of the word. I had a quarter-acre backyard. My primary go-to technique is probably going to be sheet mulching, either sectors and areas or the whole damn thing. Quarter-acre backyard, I'm going to think real hard, let's just irrigate. Let's just sheet mulch and irrigate. Because it's easy and it works and we know it's going to work. And you're going to have great results. Don't have the money for it. Now we have to start thinking water-wise, water harvesting, little micro earthworks and things like that, which we would do anyway with the irrigation, just to make it more effective. So I think all of these books are useful, but and I'm not just saying this because we sell PDCs from PermaEthos. I think that nothing replaces a PDC, unless you just get it. And if you just get it, you're probably not, you know, coming up with all these questions, right? So, like, I think I'm one of those people that after a certain amount of time, I just got it. And I just understood the troubleshooting methodology that permaculture is. Here's the problem. This is how we find a solution. And I think a lot of people don't get that. I think a lot of people take a PDC and they don't get it at first. I think you almost have to take it, you do a design, and then you have to step back. Eat a Twinkie, drink a beer, whatever does it for you, and then go design a property that you have no emotional attachment to at all. And then it kicks. Like, you need to go to a park. Sit down in a park, drink an iced tea or a hot tea or whatever, sit under a tree and look at it, and imagine to yourself, the city of Sheboyganville, who owns this park, has said to you, whatever you say to do, we will do. You have an unlimited budget. You could spend $1 million on this. You can spend $2 million on this. We will put in whatever you say to do. Just tell us what to do and we'll do it. Submit a design and we will follow it to the letter. What do we do? And then just look at it and design it. And don't worry about being wrong, because you're not going to give it to the city of Sheboyganville or whatever the name of the real city is. And they're not really going to do it. And you can't really mess it up because it's just a piece of paper. And then put that design away and wait a week. And then come back and evaluate your own design. And I think you'll learn a tremendous amount by doing that. And you'll start to think at a systems level. And you'll start to realize, well, the one thing I don't know is what is my client analysis going to be in that when I do that fictitious design? Assume you have landscape workers that are willing to do whatever you say. Because the city has people that are told to go spray this or cut that or sweep this sidewalk or whatever. So just assume there's people there to do everything. And what would you design? What would you make happen? Go look at a buddy's house and say, can I design your yard as though it was going to be permaculture? Well, I'm not going to do it. Don't care. Play along with me, though. How many hours would you spend? Zero. Okay, well, that's not going to work. Make up answers. But get out of your property that you have an emotional attachment to for just 5 minutes. Get it out of your head, and it'll all start to flow, if that makes sense. Let's take another one. So check your pattern recognition skills as you see this next question from John in Virginia. Hey, Jack, how do you really get through to people that they need to think for themselves rather than seeking plug-and-play solutions, especially in regards to permaculture design? Details. I've been working professionally as a permaculture designer for about 6 years now, and I've recently started doing more teaching-type stuff. I really helped to teach the students design portion at a PDC with Wayne Wiseman, who's very good, by the way, and have been doing lots of workshops on things like guild building, etc. My issue is that while I go seriously out of my way to show people how to build guilds, given their own unique site conditions, goals, needs, etc., they inevitably want a recipe book for all the guilds that work in the area. We both know this doesn't exist, and it would probably be a crappy idea even if it did. But what is your take on convincing people, especially in a short time format, that ideas behind all this stuff are way more important to grasp than the static blanket list of plants? Also, swales, herb spirals, hugel culture, and all the other super cool crap people want to do without actually thinking about whether or not it's a good idea or how to best implement, even if it is. Thanks, man, John in Virginia. So that seems like I just tried to explain that, doesn't it? I mean, really, that it's about this understanding. But let me see if I can talk about it again from the client side. So let's say you're my designer, and I want an apple tree in a certain area of my property, and overall that works. And I want you to tell me what works with apples. All right, look. Yeah, to be able to say, like, here's your 5 apple guilds is really not valid. But there are certain things that you can understand about this to just get off the shit, which is, okay, there's 7 layers in a forest system. If you put all 7 of those layers in, you're probably going to get a guild. So we need a ground cover, we need a root layer. Okay, comfrey. It's going to do a pretty good job of covering the ground, and it's going to be a pretty good root. Oh, wait, it's herbaceous, too. That's 3. We need some other ground cover in there, so throw some sort of creeping, climbing ground cover in with comfrey. White clover. Duh. Okay? So white clover and comfrey is a ground cover, beginning the herbaceous layer, etc. Apple tree is a tree layer. Vining layer, young tree, probably shouldn't have vines on it. Can't handle them yet. So let's just sort of kind of skip that for now. Maybe we pluck a couple beans in there every year and let them go ahead and do their thing up the tree because it won't really hurt anything. And it'll probably help protect the trunk from scalding. Okay? I mean, you can give them a guild. And I think we've overthought guilds in permaculture. Like, everybody wants this guild and that guild, and we've overthought polyculture, and just plant a whole bunch of shit. See what grows. It'll tell you what's gilding. Stop looking for that. But if that's what your customers want, and if they're willing to pay for it, then just give it to them. Because I could just start pulling guilds out of my ass left and right. Well, how do you know that works? I don't care. Because in the end, most of it will. Whatever dies just told you it doesn't want to be there. That's part of the process. So I actually do, though, think there's a place for kind of a build-a-guild mentality from a standpoint of, you know, solitary or single tree plantings. And this is what has me thinking this way. So recently somebody sent me a picture of his kids and him planting some trees. That's a small, but it's a start. And I don't know. I couldn't really tell how many trees they planted. But they planted a few trees. And where they're planting them, they're in the middle of, like, they have, like, no cover. It's just like a grass field. And they're just, I don't know if they're randomly planted or they put any really thought into their placement. But they're, like, it's like a big field. And then out in the middle of the field, there's this one little tree sticking up out of the ground. Hopefully you're going to irrigate that in this climate because this is a Texas guy. But, okay, fine. So that tree has, even with irrigation, has probably a 50-50 chance of survival. And then if it survives, it has a 50-50 chance of being a really productive, healthy, happy tree. So we're down to 25% chance that tree is going to survive and thrive and be really great, and we're really going to love it. So we're going to lose one out of four that way. Either we're going to lose it outright, or we're going to lose it in the sense that it's going to be there, but it's not going to do much for us. That's not very good odds. So the first thing that I said to this guy is, you know, put some mulch around the dadgon thing. Get some wood, chips or whatever, and put a great big ring of mulch, 3 to 4 times the existing size of that tree, at least. You know, go out, make a 6-foot circle at least around that tree of about 2 inches of wood mulch. Okay, the odds that that tree is going to turn into a thriving tree just doubled. Seriously. Just from that alone. Now, if we go out there and then we plug in about 4 comfrey roots, north, south, east, and west side of that tree, and just add comfrey to that mix, the odds that that tree is going to do well have just gone up again. There's so many things that are now going on just from those two elements. First of all, native weeds, if you want to call them that, are going to grow there that otherwise would not have. Some of them might be beneficial, some of them might be a pain in the ass, but all of them are actually beneficial. Things are going to grow and germinate underneath those wood chips beyond the grass that was just there. And that's going to bring in biodiversity. The comfrey is going to put a taproot down, and it's going to start transpiring moisture. The wood chips are going to retain the moisture. The wood chips are going to begin to break down. There's going to become fungal activity from the wood chips. No matter what, wood chips in a layer, some sort of fungal activity is going to start kicking in. Worms and creepy crawlies are going to live in there that normally would not have lived in there because they don't live out in the middle of a field baking to death. So now all we've done is wood chips and comfrey. What if we also said, well, let's just pop in some sort of an annual that will aerate that soil. Let's pop in some freaking daikon radish and turnip seeds. 10, 15, 20. Okay? And let's throw a little bit of like a medic, alfalfa, cloverish seed mix in there right before we put the wood chips down. They won't come up through the wood chips. They come up through dirt, they'll come up through wood chips. They won't all come up at the same time. They'll have different germination points and different spots when some of the wood gets moved or kicked around or messed with, and then they'll come up. And we haven't really done a guild at this point, but boy, that tree's a lot more likely to survive now. Now, if we also said, you know what, when we put those wood chips down, let's get a big tub and let's soak those wood chips in water for a few days before they go on there. And then let's take the wood chips and let's inoculate them with a mushroom spore like King Strophoria. Well, they need shade. Okay, that's fine, because all those little plants, like the daikon and the comfrey and maybe a couple bean seeds or whatever, and maybe a little bit of cowpea, all that's going to provide shade. Now we're going to enhance the fungal activity there. And, you know, well, then just throw a blackberry there, at because now you got this big mulched area, and it's a little bitty tree in the middle, and all this space. Well, let's just start plugging some. What do you like to eat? I like blueberries. Well, you live where there's alkaline soil, so you need to put those in a flower pot. What else do you like to eat? What berries do you eat? Strawberries. Bang on. Pop a couple, what do you call them? Strawberries. I'm trying to think of the ones that put out the sisters. The climbing, like, spreading strawberries. Plop a couple of those in there. Probably a little bit to the rear of the comfrey to give them some break from the sun in the late summer. What else do you like? You like blackberries? Let's throw a blackberry in there. Sort of freestanding or primocane blackberry. And let's put it on the south side of the tree to shade the trunk of the tree because it can handle more sun. And it's that easy. And I think that if a person doesn't want to learn that, then just tell them, you know what? I'll design it for you. It's going to cost you money. I'm not going to give you a list of all the guilds that work in your area. That's a stupid idea. Tell them it's stupid. That's a dumb idea because no one knows. Because your backyard and the next guy's backyard are different. But in the end, we don't need to be designing guilds. All you have to do is, well, what grows here? Plums, cherries, apples. Gee, there's a start. Right? Strawberries, blackberries, blueberries, raspberries, currants, whatever grows. What grows there? Put that shit there. It's that simple. Seed mixes, mix 20 different things together. Put it in a bag. Say it's, I don't know, $15 a pound. Wow, that's expensive. That's because you didn't learn how to do it yourself. By the way, I just mixed a bunch of shit together. Here you go, $15 a pound. It's special. I mean, I hate to be that blunt about it, but I mean, that's where we're at with this, right? We're making that which is simple complicated solely for the purpose. And I think part of it is everybody wants to invent something. Everybody wants to be famous for something. Everybody wants to write a book. Everybody wants to be the first person to do something. That's why everybody goes, well, I'm going to make a hoogelswale, with no idea whether that's a good idea or not. And most of the time, it's not. Swale is one type of technology. Hoogelbed's another. Hoogels are best for the propagation of annuals and small perennials like bushes and shrubs. Okay. Hoogel mounds are not where we plant a pear tree that's going to be 18 feet tall, because hoogel mounds collapse over time. Swales are tree-growing systems. So why would we take an annual and small perennial technology like a hoogel mound and try to push it into a tree-growing system like a swale? Well, the two are absolutely not compatible. Now, if there's a whole bunch of timber that has to come down anyway, and one or two logs are laid in the ground in a straight line along the swale line, and we dump the swale on top of it, and that helps put a kind of a fungal inoculation, carbon sequestration, organic matter, nutrient trap thing in there. That's fine, because it just fell into place that way. That makes sense. But anyway, I don't want to beat this one up too much. I want to go into some other variety today, but those of you in the permaculture world, this is the struggle that we have. We have to stop making shit complicated. In the end, plant a whole bunch of different shit and see what grows. And stop overthinking things. Let's take another one. All right, so next up, this is one that must have almost choked my email server to death. It came from so many people. I'm reading one here from Rob, but many of you sent this in. Mandatory voting. Obama floats the idea of making voting mandatory. This is something, man. I don't know whether I am more concerned about the fact that this is being floated or more concerned about how hysterical and ridiculous the reaction is. But what I'm actually going to do before I comment on this, instead of reading the article, I'm on Fox News, my Fox Detroit. Obama floats the idea of making voting mandatory, and there's a video. So I'm just going to go ahead and play the video for you, and then I'll come back with my thoughts on this and why I think it's a wonderful sign of things to come. I think it's actually a really good thing, and I'm not being sarcastic, and maybe you'll see why I feel that way when I come back. Anyway, I'll be right back. But here we go. Here's a story from my Fox Detroit.
A big part of the game of politics is trying to figure out who's actually going to show up at the polls. What the president is talking about is a system where turnout would never be an issue. Every political campaign in this country ultimately comes down to this one message.
You gotta vote! Don't boo! Vote! Gotta vote!
So imagine if a candidate in this country never had to say that again, if turnout was just assumed. That is what the president is talking about.
In Australia and some other countries, there's mandatory voting. It would be transformative if everybody voted.
He's right. In Australia, it is mandatory that people vote, and you can be fined if you don't, the equivalent of about $15. And a handful of other countries do something similar.
If everybody voted, then it would completely change the political map in this country.
And it's an idea that for many candidates might break down right along party lines, because most polls show that there are more Democrats than Republicans out there. Force everyone to vote, and Democrats will have an advantage. But there are some other issues as well. Some people see non-voting as a political statement, and it may run afoul of the First Amendment.
Look, first, I don't put anything past them.
One potential 2016 Republican candidate for the White House thinks it's a bad idea.
Not voting is also a legitimate choice that some people make. I wish more people would participate in politics, too, but that is their choice. That is the choice of living in a free society.
And in many elections, most voters choose not to participate. In last year's midterm elections, the turnout among eligible voters was less than 40%. In Washington, Doug Luzader, Fox News.
Well, you might wonder, how the hell would Jack think this is a good idea? I think this is a good thing, not a good idea, but a good thing on many levels. Let's start out with the discussion that it causes being, first of all, a good thing. So the announcer says, at the beginning of this story, a big part of the game of politics. I'm overjoyed. It's probably by accident anyway, though, but overjoyed that a major news mouthpiece just referred to politics as a game, because that's what it is. It's an effing game. It is a theatrical display put on display for the masses so that you can delusionarily believe that you somehow really do have influence with your vote. There are millions of government employees. There are less than 600 at the federal level that stand election, and at most, you can vote for four of them. Let's just let that sink in for a minute. Yeah, it's a game. The next thing is, well, in Australia, they have it. It's mandatory. It's transformative, and you can be fined like up to $15 for not voting. Do you know what the voter turnout in Australia was last election? 81%. Let's do a little bit of math. Let's just do a little bit of math. Australia has about 23 million people. If we take 20% of that number, we get about 4.6 million. Of course, some of them are kids. Let's assume half of them are kids. And we get 2.3 million people then that still abstained from voting in Australia last year. You think they sent a fine to 2.3 million people? You want to work that out on 300 million people? So if they did this here, and if the majority of people that don't vote, who probably would do this, would just say, screw off, I'm not doing it anyway, you can't make me, didn't vote, and only 40% of our population voted, let's say they got a whopping 20% increase, and they got up to 60% of our population voted. Well, in the United States, we know there's actually about 235 million eligible voters. Not registered, but eligible. About 235 million people in the United States are old enough to vote. We can actually get that information. And that's as of 2012. So if anything, there's more. Well, if 40% of those people decided not to vote, that would be 94 million people. What are you going to do? You going to send the police out after they're done seizing some guy's pigs or horses? To arrest 94, you can't deport 30 million people. You sure as hell can't force 94 million people that don't want to go vote. I also think that this story is being a little bit overplayed by the right-leaning media. Because if you actually listen to what Barack Obama says in this, he said that if everybody voted, it would be transformative. And he did point out that it is mandatory in Australia, but he did not say we should make voting mandatory in the United States. That is not what he said. That's not what he said. That's not what he said, and no matter how many times you want to believe that's what this guy said, it's not what he said. This is yet another example of taking something stupid a politician has said and making it out to be even more stupid than it was. It is what it is. But I think if we actually had the idea floated for real that we should have mandatory voting in this country, I think it would be good. And I think that the fact that it's even being discussed is a great sign. And do you know why? Because, what have I said? The greatest weapon of the American people is our apathy towards them. A belief that we don't need you. See, the reason this is even being discussed is they're scared shitless about the implications of having voter turnout continue to decline. See, you gotta vote. You gotta vote. You gotta vote. Don't boo, vote. Bullshit. Not voting is a vote. I mean, let's keep in mind that as a senator, that this guy didn't show up for like 80% of the votes in the Senate. As a senator, where his job was to vote, let's let that go for a second. And let's examine this. I gotta vote. Why? You've given me two people to choose for president of the United States. I find them both to be traitors to the Constitution of the United States. Neither one of them worthy of my endorsement, so my vote is for neither. Since you failed to put neither on the ballot, which I think would be legitimate, by the way, to put neither on the ballot, none of the above on the ballot, I think that should be there. Since you haven't done that for me, I will vote neither by abstaining. But you're a quitter then, Jack, and you're surrendering. Surrendering to what? Surrendering to what? What would you have me do? Now, I think it'd be interesting if they passed this mandatory thing and, you know, 100 plus million people that never voted before showed up and continued to do something that many people that do vote do, and that's do a write-in candidate. And my understanding is there's a rumor going around that Mickey Mouse is the number one write-in candidate. And by making all those other people voted, if they did so, Mickey might win. Who would be in charge then? Disney Corporation. Oh, we'd be right back where we started then. Because they're one of the major media outlets that control everything anyway. So maybe we shouldn't vote for Mickey. Maybe our write-in should be, I don't know. I don't know who we would write in for president. Don't write me in. I don't want the job. I think anybody worth having as your president probably doesn't want to be president. But the overall signal of like saying we should make voting mandatory, that's so Democrats can get in. No, it's not. No, it's not. Well, there's more Democrats out there. You're not either if you don't vote. You're not either if you don't vote. This is nonsense. The reality is you could have a 10% voter turnout. And you would probably end up with the same results to most elections. Most, not all, but most. You can poll a few thousand people in every major district, and you can predict elections with about 97% accuracy. What does that tell you? That it's all pre-written. People are snapping to it. People are figuring it out. You know, when you say that someone has to vote, think about what you're saying. You're saying that I am required to give my endorsement to a person that I believe to be a traitor to the Constitution, that if they win, they will need to swear to uphold and defend. And I'll tell you what this tells me. Not voting has a bigger impact than voting for a third party. Voting for a third party isn't throwing your vote away. I think voting anymore is throwing your vote away. But they don't care. They wouldn't give a shit. If you had an 80% voter turnout, and third party's got 20% of the vote, they wouldn't even take notice. They'd say the system is working perfectly for us. But here's the thing. The fact that there's a million Facebook memes about this now just shows you how easy you are to control as a people. This nation's so easy to control. See, here's what happened with this. Obama makes this statement kind of off the cuff. He left the teleprompter for a few moments. Never a good thing for him when he does. He gives an honest assessment of something. And he gives the assessment that basically is like this. You know, it'd be great if everybody voted. In Australia, they got mandatory voting. I think it'd be transformative for the country if everybody could vote did. That's what the guy basically says. And as some guy on Fox News says, we could spin this. Obama floats plan for mandatory voting. that sounds good. So he floats that. The next guy up in the executive producer reels goes, yeah, that works. Yeah, let's run that. So they run that. 90% of the people that are pissed off about this never actually heard the comments that were made. All they read is the headline, and they say, look at this totalitarian state that's rising. We need to get rid of Obama in 2016. Obama's not running in 2016. No, they're not going to do a constitutional amendment like Alex Jones said so, okay? Right? We got to stop Hillary. Whatever. I mean, this is stupid. This is just another demonstration point of how easy it is to control people in this country with a little bit of misinformation. Again, though, the good news is they are thinking this way. They are starting to realize that they're losing control of a significant portion of the population. Let me tell you, waving the flag for one side versus the other, they still control you. When you say, I will not participate in this mass delusion any further, that's when they lose control of you. And the fact that that's even coming up shows me that the people in power are starting to fear just that. They're starting to fear a true insurrection. A true insurrection where people just start to say, that's nice that you think that. We're going to do what we want. We're going to start building our own lives our own way, and we will fight you when you engage us. And as long as you leave us alone, we will just stay out of your bullshit. No, stay. You can't. You got to vote. No, I don't really have to. The election's predetermined. You're both bought and paid for anyway. I don't want either one of you, so F off out of my face. Leave me alone. Don't bother me. And it's the point where they start bothering us that they may indeed learn the old historical lesson of waking a sleeping giant. What they're becoming concerned about is the sheer number of people who are choosing to abstain from their system, not due to pathetic apathy, but due to productive apathy. We are not apathetic people. We are apathetic to their false illusion, their phony reality. We are apathetic to the belief that we actually influence what they do and therefore have decided to focus on what we actually influence. That is frightening to people that maintain their power through the use of creative illusion. Because there's a very small percentage necessary to break through the illusion, to hit a critical mass where it becomes self-evident. There's an old saying that's true here, and it's attributed to Schopenhauer, who was a German philosopher, lived from 1788 to 1860. And there's some question as to whether he's really the person that originated it, but it's called the three stages of truth. And what it says is that all truth passes through three stages. First, it's ridiculed. Second, it's violently opposed. And third, it's accepted as being self-evident. So the first thing that's been done with those of us who don't vote and don't participate in this mass delusion is to ridicule us. You're quitters, you're surrenderers, you're whatever, right? People get really mad, so you start heading toward violent opposition right away. So when I see something like the concept of mandatory voting, bring it, baby. That's that violent opposition that comes right before being accepted as self-evident. And what's being accepted as self-evident here is not that you cannot have a society where people make decisions through a democratic process. But the democratic process that we have in place right now is purely an illusion. It's made up of people who are elected to bought and paid for positions by people that actually have the real power. And when that's accepted as self-evident, it's on then. It's on like Donkey Kong at that point. And that's what they're afraid of. Because as you've ridiculed people like us, and I'm not saying like you're wrong if you vote, I think if you vote because you actually think your vote matters, you're you're not wrong as like it's a bad thing to be the person that does that, but you are wrong in your assessment that it's going to do anything. If you vote out of some sense of patriotic duty or whatever, that's your thing, man. I don't want to, you know, get on anybody for that. I would never say that you're a bad person because you vote. But you should think more about what you're voting about, like how to control other people. You know, do you really want to control other people? Do you really want, and you know, well, I'm voting for more freedom. Well, who are you voting for then? Because I'd like to know who's going to do that. Right? It's just which type of oppression do we get is what you're voting for. But, you know, that's all fine and well. But as long as you're doing that, they feel like, hey, you know what? We've got these people. We got them right where we want them. But when you stop worrying about, see, this is the thing. It's not just about the action of voting or not voting. I think a person could vote once every 2 or 4 years and go out and be even halfway relatively informed in about 5 minutes on the issues that you're voting on and spend the rest of your time not paying attention. And that would be just as bad for them. Just when you don't vote, it's a signal that you're one of those people, right? Because they know that when 60% of eligible voters don't vote, that maybe 20% are the people just don't give an F about anything. They don't care left, right, center. They don't care. They don't not care proactively. They don't care. They just don't give a shit. They're too young. They're too old. They're too tired. They're too whatever. They just don't care. They never cared. Nothing's ever going to make them care. And even if you made voting mandatory, they're the 20% in Australia that still don't vote. They don't care. Okay? There's 40% of people that have made a conscious decision, no. That's as many people as have made a conscious decision of yes. Holy shit. We're now at a point where there's an equal number of people that know we're full of shit. And they're starting to talk about it. Now, all of those people have, in the past, generally been the type of people that are just going to work, coming home, paying their taxes. They don't care. You're still in the system. But now what we're starting to see is people building businesses, innovating, leaving the damn country, renouncing their citizenship, getting creative in how they structure their finances, getting active, using things like Bitcoin, which is just the first step in the right direction. People going off grid, and not like a bunch of hippies did in the 60s, like in the 70s. This is like a full-on insurrection starting to happen. And it's in little pockets here and there. And what they're afraid of is it's almost like a bunch of splinter cells. And what happens if they all start to coalesce and work together? What if they start putting aside their differences? Oh, they'll never do that. Wait a minute. We're the reason they have all those differences. And they're not paying attention to us anymore. This is a very scary place for the power elite to be right now. When people start turning their hand, saying, you talk to the hand, like the remember the old thing that all the little girls were doing to their daddies back not too long ago, right? Talk to the hand, the face ain't listening. Tell you what, I'm glad I didn't have a little girl give me that crap because she would have been in her room for a month. But anyway, I'm all for it. Let's do it. Let's go mandatory voting. Let's pass that shit. Let's go. I'm not going to do it. You're not going to make me. You'll have to come get your $15 if you want it or whatever. And good luck with that. But the reason I'm for it, it makes me think of watching poker on TV, which I find boring, but it does give me a good analogy. When you watch poker, and let's say you pretend to be one of the players, they show you everybody else's hand, okay? And it would be real easy for you to know when to get up and walk away from the table if the other side showed you their hand, wouldn't it? You'd be like, oh, I'm beat, right? That's why you don't get to see the hand until the end of the game. That's why you can bluff. That's why there could be an illusion that the other side has a higher hand, or the illusion that you could win, that the game's not rigged, that it's an honest game. Well, the day they require mandatory voting in this country, they will show their hand. And I think a whole shitload of people will get up and walk away from the table. And in the end, that's what we need. We have a system that's so parasitic, that is so horrific in what it's doing around the world and in our own backyard, that the only way to stop it isn't to reform it, but to dismantle it. My concern is when that eventually happens, I hope we have something better to put back in place. And my concern is that we don't. And that vacuum could be worse than the problem that we have, as bad as it is. But in the end, if you continue to mislead a people, it is only a matter of time before they figure it out. And I've said it before, but an honest man recognizes a rigged game and seeks his entertainment elsewhere. That's why I've walked away from a lot of this. I see the rigged game. I know it's unwinnable. I know it's a version of three-card Monty. And I'm not willing to be hustled any longer. In the end, I did a show not long ago called Turn Off the Frickin' News. With this story, turn off the frickin' news. Stop paying attention. It doesn't matter. They're not going to do shit. They have no power to make you vote. And if I am ever made to vote, I'll request a paper ballot. I'll wipe my butt with it and tell them to figure out what that means. Let's take another one. Here's something I think is a fabulous idea. It's called a Yelp for teachers. If the schools won't make metrics public, maybe the public should make some metrics of its own. Let's have a discussion this week about transparency and accountability. No, I'm not talking about Hillary Clinton and a server that lives in her attic. I'm talking instead about teachers' unions and the fight to keep classroom evaluations secret. In ex-urban London County, Virginia, about half hour's drive from Washington, a parent named Brian Davidson is suing the state because it won't release the ratings of public school teachers get based on the test scores of their students. The Washington Post reports the Virginia suit is part of a growing national debate over new data ratings in the classroom. The question Davison and other parents are asking is why schools won't share these numeric evaluations with us. The question that occurs to me, though, is exactly the reverse. Isn't it time that parents shared their own evaluations with everybody else? Before I get to that, let's first take a closer look at the arguments against releasing the data on individual teachers. They come down to two very important principles, fairness and privacy. The unions don't like the kind of test-based evaluation that the president's race to the top reform agenda encourages because it seems to them like a pretty subjective way to define teacher effectiveness. If you're a baseball fan, you'll recognize these value-added ratings as a distant relation to what the new statisticians calls win above replacement value for the player. They're based on a mathematical average, but they're entirely theoretical. Did Derek Jeter give up more runs statistically speaking than average shortstop? Yes. Did you want Jeter as your shortstop anyway? Absolutely. A public school teacher who ignites the imagination that most of us had someone like that might just be worth more than one whose students have demonstrated mastery of the Pythagorean theorem. And as the Post story points out, even some reformers who advocate using these new statistical measurements are hesitant to see them released because it smacks of public shaming. Think about it. Would you want your boss to publish your less than flattering workplace evaluation? Let me stop there for a second. Okay? No. Unless the public's paying my salary, in which case my performance should be available to the public. If you're a shitty teacher being funded with public funds, the public has a right to know you're a shitty teacher. I'm just saying. But instead of letting government fix it, what about a private way to fix this problem? What about a private industry solution? So I'm going to skip down a little bit out in the article to this. Maybe what we need and what teachers should welcome isn't the data on the test scores and value-added rankings that some parents are demanding, or at least not that alone. What we need is for some tech entrepreneur to come up with a Yelp or an Angie's List for public schools, because the amalgamated voice of the consumer is the most powerful kind of accountability in American life. Skeptics will point out, I'm sure, that such a system doesn't exist because the intelligence you'd gain isn't actionable. That is, if the refrigerator you wanted to buy gets 3 stars out of 5, you just buy another one. If the teacher your kid is likely to get has consistently low ratings, there's nothing you can really do about it anyway except suffer through the school year, so why bother keeping track? But the same can be said of these metrics that the unions and their political allies are fighting so hard to conceal. The point of empowering parents isn't to enable them to game the system. The point is to give the small minority of teachers who fall behind some useful feedback on what's not working and some genuine incentive to fix it. I suspect the unions won't like this suggestion any more than they like value-added data or the idea of making it public. I suspect that they're reflexive defenders of the status quo who will read it and brand it as just another form of teacher bashing, which is how they dismiss all talk of modernization. They shouldn't, though, because the bottom line is that accountability and metrics are are infiltrating public education, whether you like it or not. The best thing for teachers is to encourage more ways of evaluating the performance, not fewer. Letting consumers have their say, combined with whatever other useful matrix we can come up with, would be a whole lot more enlightening than just plugging in a bunch of scores without any context. Should we teach the parents at least as much as we teach the test? Here's what I think. I think it's a brilliant idea. I think that using it to reform public education ain't going to happen, which seems to be what the author wants, but they're probably at a different walk in life right now and thinking this is messed up. And I think that you walk towards the realm of let's just build new systems very slowly. I mean, there's a certain attachment to the way things are because they do work to a certain degree. So this is probably a person that'll end up mentally where I'm at a few years down the road, most likely anyway. But I think it serves both agendas pretty well. I think about it this way. Why isn't there this? Why doesn't somebody just do this? I bet you, with a very simple, like a script, this could be done almost immediately. I bet that there's free scripts out there that are basically clones of Yelp. And that to tailor this to something like public education would be really easy. And I think that you could have reviewers like classified in different levels, like student and parent and fellow teacher. So it'd be interesting to see what your fellow teachers think about you, the parents of the students think about you, and the students themselves think about you. Now, the issue would be that the student might face reprisal, but the student could write the review after leaving the class, right? Or the student could write the review anonymously. Now, would there be students that would write hateful, mean reviews of teachers just because they're hateful, mean little cusses? Sure. But what would be the preponderance there? And what would people put the most weight in? I think your fellow teachers to a degree. But I think that's also like a pretty poor metric. I think the best person to write these reviews is the parent. The parent's the customer. Okay? The parent's the customer. When you go out and buy your kid tennis shoes, the kid's not the customer. Right, the kid might be part of the marketing. You convince the kid that he has to have the shoes, and he bitches to the parents. But in the end, the parent makes the purchasing decision, right? So even though the kid gets the shoes, the customer is the parent, okay? In public education, the parent's the one that pays the bill. The parent's the one that decides what school district they're going to live in. The parent's the one that decides, you put my kid in Mrs. Smith's class, and I'm going to let you do that, or I'm going to come down there and pitch a fit, and you know, my child is not going to be in her class. Now, wouldn't it be interesting if some of the shitty teachers, like, you have no recourse. No, that's not really true. What would a school have to do if they had, like, four people teaching second grade? And based on this type of evaluation, which would be fair and unbiased, right, because it actually is being done by the customer, who actually has the biggest stake in this, said, we have a Mrs. Smith, a Mrs. Jones, a Mrs. Thompson, and a Mrs. Wilson. And 80 or 90% of the parents came down and said, my child is not going to be in Mrs. Wilson's class, period. I've read too much, I've seen too much, and you're not doing it. If you do not place my child into another classroom, I will refuse to send them to school. What are they going to do? Oh, you will do what we say. Okay, try that. See how it works out. What do you think you might have the school board's attention too? Huh. Now, what also would be interesting is for parents to have this collective intelligence to see that their impression of this teacher is wrong or not wrong. Might also reveal an awful lot of what's wrong with the current system. Now, see, the problem here is we're limiting it to the teachers. Well, teachers are not necessarily the problem. They're just part of the problem. So we would also need a Yelp-type application that wasn't just for the individual teachers, because I believe there are shitty teachers in the system. And I believe they're probably 10 to 20%. And the rest are probably pretty good at what they do for the system they have to work with. But the system itself has a lot more problems. So what if the school districts and the individual schools were up for review? And what if the principals were? and the vice principals and the guidance counselors. What if there was this Yelp application that also had listed all of the people in the school districts? And when somebody made a phone call to their member of the school board that represents their area and had an interaction with that person's office, they were able to, you know, post a review on that. And why aren't we doing this with everything now? Works for eBay, it works for Amazon, works for Angie's List. Why aren't we doing it with our schools? Why aren't we doing it with the police departments? Why aren't we doing it with police departments? Well, you know, it's the same thing. Like, you can't not use your chief of police. I can move. I can move, can't I? Do you know how much effort goes into certain school districts marketing that they have the best test scores in the area or whatever? Do you know why? Because they know that while a lot of people aren't necessarily going to leave, there's a lot of people that might never show up. See, when I get a new job and I have to move, one of my primary concerns as a parent is what school will my child go to? Now, this might have something to do with the individual districts, like, you know, in my area, like, you know, Mansfield or Fort Worth or whatever, okay? But it also has to do with the individual schools themselves. So you might find out, and people do this all the time. Well, they would be in XYZ school district. Okay, but which schools would they go to? What is the middle school? What is the junior high? What is the high school for this house, for this zip code? And when they find out, sometimes when it's between two houses, they even move to the same district, but they choose house A over B because they know the school has a better reputation based on very thin information right now. What if they had access to all this? And what if you found out, when you evaluated the area you were going to move to, that the law enforcement personnel in your community had a habit of showing up late when they were called, had a habit of lying to citizens, had a habit of doing anything negative, or had a reputation of being good community officers of the peace that were responsive, that were respectful, that did their best to help people, that weren't abusive, and you could move to either City A or City B, and you went up to their overall Yelp, which covers their schools, their law enforcement, their city council, their school board, everything. And you saw this one was really, really, really highly rated, and this one not so much. And you could afford to live in either one of them. Might that influence what you decide to do? See, this is the concepts and the hallmarks of a republic. This is a nation that in of itself is not just supposed to be a republic, but each state is supposed to be a republic within the republic, with the different cities and counties. And that's why do you know that every state in our republic is required to have the one big limitation? Their state government must be, and not the party, not the political party, but the government of every state must be a republican form of government. This is so that citizens have freedom of movement and freedom of choice. And if state A does something stupid, people might move to state B. But if county A or city A does something stupid, the citizenry can freely up and move to city B. It's the final check on authority and power and quality of life and regulation and everything else. So why aren't we doing, why limit this to teachers who are the smaller part of the problem? Why not do this for schools as a whole? Why not do it for school districts? Why not for principals? Why not for school board members? I mean, you might as well forget members of Congress and what have you, but maybe the state level, you know, like the state senators and state reps, maybe there needs to be a Yelp for them too. Might be really interesting where this could go. This is one of the ways to turn technology back on the machine. It's an incomplete thought right now. It's something that, like, it's like, well, I can do this, right? Just do whatever you can. Like, anybody out there could pick one vertical, you know, one vertical niche in this world. And there's probably, I'd like to hear from you, what are other things we could develop Yelp-like technologies for that would help people make decisions about where to live? Because when you make a decision about where to live, you have a direct impact on the treasury of that locality. And by not going somewhere else, you have a negative impact. I mean, it's part of what Walking to Freedom is all about. If you live in a state that sucks, go somewhere that doesn't suck as bad. But what if we started to really get nebulous on this? What if we got down to the point where people would start making decisions with as little as 5 miles apart based on the schools, with full, well-informed decisions? The schools, police chiefs, law enforcement officer, county sheriff? Boy, that sounds a lot more productive than voting, because it is voting in an actual meaningful way. See, the governments of this country, and I say governments, right, at all levels, require things to be functional and to get what they want. And one is your money, definitely. That's what we always think about. But they also need your participation. They need your time, your attention, your talent, and your residency. See, the federal government has your residency cold. Very few of us are going to leave, and far more people want to come here than want to leave, even in the current situation. So the federal government's out on that one. You can't really do much. The state of Florida, though, very much wants you to come there and doesn't want you to leave. But the city of Tallahassee has its own problems with that. And I think we need public, editable, and reviewable type technologies for every form of government service out there. Not just some guy that's angry posting a blog, but why don't we have this for code officials and code enforcement? I mean, wouldn't it be interesting if you saw the code enforcement of a city was rated really, really high, but at the same time you understood why it was rated highly? Is it rated highly because it's lax and they leave people alone? Well, that might be where you want to live. Or is it rated highly because there's a bunch of anal blue hairs in that area that want everything rigorously enforced, and that's exactly what they do? Wouldn't it be great if you could then look at those two and make a decision for yourself and say, I am not going to live with these people that want rigorous enforcement. I want lapse enforcement. Starting to sound a lot like anarchy to me. Not without rules, but without a state. What if you started to make these decisions based on the collective will as represented by government versus having your will enforced by government? We'd actually be on the pathway to, believe it or not, anarchy. It's not perfect, but it's the right direction. Just a different way of looking at things. Anyway, I had some more stuff, but I think I'm going to wrap up there today. I think we've covered enough. But I like this idea, this Yelp technology idea, this Angie's List style technology. I mean, I could see it being done with law enforcement officers. Let me be honest with you. If I got pulled over by a police officer, and he wrote me a ticket for speeding, and I felt like, you know, I was only 7 over, but I knew I was speeding. And he was courteous and polite and did his job, asked for my license, registration, proof of insurance. I gave it to him. He did his thing, wasn't an asshole to me, wrote me a ticket and sent me on my way. And I had this technology. I would pull up the iPhone and do a review. Officer Smith, badge number 619, blah, 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 blah. Tarrant County Sheriff's Department or Fort Worth Police Department, whatever. Overall experience. I received a ticket. However, officer was polite, respectful of my rights, well informed, and I was I was either advised or I don't feel that I was, but I'm going to go, take this up in court. Why don't we write a review of the judges in these court systems too? You know, a lot of these judges are elected, or they're appointed by people that we elect. People don't know. I mean, when you go, all you people say it's so important to vote. You know damn well that most of you, when you get to the ballot and you look at 80% of the people on the ballot for all these minor positions, you have no idea who they are, what they stand for, or what they even do. What if this was really obvious to people? I think that it almost needs to be I don't know. Like, it's like, let the market figure out. Is it better that it's in pieces, parts, or a unified platform? I don't know, but I'd like to see it. I don't think it's hard. I don't think it's something that's technically hard to do. It'd be interesting, too. I mean, could you imagine you're going to be going to a small town, right? And you pull up their Yelp version, right? And you can see, like, okay, this town only has 12 police officers. Here's their reviews. These guys have a tendency to be assholes. You know what? On this business trip, let's look at Sheboyganville instead. Huh. Fair, courteous, yeah. Yeah, you know what? I'm going to go spend my money in Sheboyganville instead of Westchestertonville. How long before the chambers of commerce, with all the influential people in these towns and cities and counties and boroughs, go, you know what, guys? We're losing business because of you. We don't like this. I don't know. Maybe it's the Republican action. Maybe it's the way the Republican function. I'm not sure. I'd love your thoughts on it. With that, this has been Jack Spirko with another edition of the Survival Podcast, helping you figure out that better how to live that better life if times get tough, or even if they don't. Seeing our food these days, you know it's on our TVs. Sometimes we forget we are what we eat. I don't know the answer. It's like there's nothing I can do. It's the price we pay, I guess, when we follow all the rules. There's a better way to do this. Let me show you a better way. Someday we'll realize our children just can't pay. Nobody up there cares, they're living for today. Revolution is you.